Hello, hello, and welcome to the SBS Cycling Podcast for the week of the 26th of March 2015. This is your weekly review of all things cycling. I'm Al Hines. This week on the show, Milan-San Remo ends with a German winner and John Degenkolb. We talk about Tinkoff Saxo and the row that's been exploding between Bjarne Riis and Mr. Oleg. And we'll talk about the Vuelta a Catalunya. That's the race between Barcelona and Girona and back again, I guess. That's all in this week's show. It's going to be a cracker as always. And with me to talk about that and more, Anthony Tan, Phil Gomes, and Ride Media's Rob Arnold. Guys, welcome aboard.
Thanks, Al. We're back in the studio. Well, not from San Remo, but after San Remo.
Not San Ramp or Milano or...
No. The last time I covered San Remo in the field was 2005 when a guy called Pataki won. That happened to be on the Via Roma.
Was that the 1-2?
No, just no. The one. Well, 1-2-3. There was three people on the podium.
I feel like there was a year. Was there a year where Zabel and they both sort of went over the line together?
Oh, that was when Frère got the better of Zabel.
Yeah, that was a classic as well. Yeah. Anyway, there's a lot of classics in the Classica, as they sometimes... Classica?
La Classicissima.
Well, it's because it's very classic, basically.
Yeah. It's extra, extra classic.
It's the most classic.
I think what people were sort of in suspense about was how the change to the Via Roma, because it shortened the...
The time from the Poggio.
From the Poggio to the Via Roma was a whole kilometre, which is a lot when you're reducing it, say, from 4 to 3 kilometres to the finish line. But
we'll talk about Milan-San Remo in full in a second, Tanny. But Rob, we didn't really mention it. We didn't really give it a plug last week. New magazine is on the shelves.
Yes, exactly. Thank you very much. Thank you kindly. That was Thursday. It went on sale on Friday. You'll see Rowan Dennis, man of the hour, on the cover. And please buy it. It's got lots of juicy reading and a good bike reviews. And we look at every bike from the world tour. So thanks for allowing me to put a plug in. If you like cycling, you should like Ride Cycling Review.
It makes sense because it's pretty much all the words of riding and cycling and reviewing, and it's all in there. It's a big tome these
look
days.
Look out for it.
So
it's
much
always
pages.
A big tome. We've been doing it since 1998, and it gets bigger and
more
and,
tomey.
Tell us.
It needs its own course of clenbuterol to just kind of slow down.
I don't know where to go with that one.
All right, guys, let's just get straight into it.
Wait, hold on.
Phil. Welcome, Phil.
You've already made your little asides.
Well, no, but that was just a snark.
Phil, how are you? You're actually in good snark form lately, I feel. If everyone's been following Philip Gomes on Twitter, I suggest you do, @Philip_Gomes. You've been really... I mean, you tend to put out a few subtweets, but you're in absolutely golden form lately.
I love the subtweet. But speaking of Pataki, wasn't he at some kind of Grand Fondo in Argentina or something like that while Milan-San Remo was on?
I think he was. He's not particularly interested in anything. Well, that's what bike riders develop a
that's the modern
narcissistic
trajectory.
Side, don't they?
Yeah, that's the modern trajectory of a pro bike rider. You know, usually they'd open a shop, but now they just start their own Grand Fondo.
Yeah. Levi, George, the whole cabal. All right, guys, let's get into it and let's get on to Milan-San Remo. Alexander Kristoff came so very close to making it back-to-back Milan-San Remo titles on the Via Roma, but a late surge in a blanket finish saw German John Degenkolb nab the win over the Norwegian. Third went to an Aussie, that was Michael Matthews, while many of the usual suspects made up the top 10. Peter Sagan was once again the architect of his own demise, with exuberance getting the better of him over the Poggio. And despite a valiant effort, Fabian Cancellara had to settle for seventh, ending a golden run from him of consecutive, consistent monument finishes. I think he's not been off the podium in 12 before this, which is damn impressive.
An apology from me. I said Michael Matthews would win.
Well, and you
and he came third.
Yeah. Well, that's because you were speaking to him and you said he was going to win, and that was his own commentator's curse.
No, I've been saying that for months.
Commentator's curse.
He came second. I mean, he came third. But it was a very close third.
It was a close third, but let's, I suppose, recap the race. It was that sort of usual run-in, the Cipressa and the Poggio, attacks flew, the guys that sort of aren't really going to win. I think Geraint Thomas was in a move, and you're sort of going,
I did think he was going to win for a second.
No, you were mistaken.
A millisecond. A millisecond's not much over 294 kilometres.
But Katusha, very impressive. I thought Paolini was very impressive in keeping it really controlled for Christoph. And you thought for a minute, well, for quite a while, actually, I thought, well, Christoph's looking very good for doubling up. But
until he spent about 350 metres in the wind at the end.
Yeah.
And had it, yeah, I mean, he was... Considering how long he was sprinting for in the wind without any support.
How close he came to actually.
Pretty impressive.
Can I just ask one question of Anthony and Rob? When was the last time there was a backup winner at MSR?
That would have to be Ferrero, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Was it 2003,
2004 or something? No, I think Zabel was the last back-to-back winner, and before him, Zabel again.
So Zabel, he's pretty solid.
Yeah.
But it would have been. It's pretty rare for people. Basically, in essence, it's quite rare for people to win back to back.
Yeah, I just thought the reason why Christoph failed was he dropped off too early, or he started too early, but he had to because there was no other guy in front of him. And then also, he wasn't in the same nick that he was in last year. You could see he was suffering really badly on the. I thought he was going to get dropped actually on the. On the Cipressa.
On the Cipressa, he was pretty much gone out of the equation. Swinging. And then we saw Popeye come to the fore, and Paolini, that is. And he just was phenomenal. I think, Christoph has to give him a big bonus.
Far out. I mean, if it wasn't for Paolini, I would have said Christoph wouldn't even been in the running.
Anyway, we're not even talking about the guy that actually won the race, and that was John Dankel.
Because we only saw him for that millisecond as he crossed the line.
Which, experience tells you, is the reason that he won. Because,
impressive.
I mean, Milan-San Remo, I think, is really the race where you don't want to do anything until you actually have to. I mean, Simon Gerrans jumped onto Cancellara's move when he won. Matty Goss marked the moves, keeping himself really conservative. And last year, I think Christoph, very, very conservative race. Even Scholik, I suppose, was a fairly conservative race. I mean, the guys that win it are the guys that...
you don't see.
They're not doing dramatic moves over the Poggio. They're keeping themselves very, very well protected, and that's what Dagenkolb did. Tanner, you wrote a blog about him. You're quite complimentary.
Yeah, I thought it was very similar to Scholik's win. It was similar to Gossi's win. And I just felt he did... exactly what he needed to do, and he said he needed four times. He needed 4 years to get it right, and I did think Matthews had the form. He looked so good on the Cipressa and Poggio. I thought, okay, I thought Rob's nailed this one. He's going to get it, but you know he was a little bit too present when he didn't need to be.
But he wasn't wasting energy. He was playing the perfect patient game, and he rode a tactically brilliant race over the climbs and delivered himself into the finish. He just got boxed, and it was not about speed or power. He had that. Mm. It's just that he didn't have the room to move. He went over to the right side of the road. He needed to go left, and he ultimately chose to go left a little bit too late.
Although a whisper in his ear, you know, I think don't follow Peter Sagan's wheel over the Poggio would be not out of place.
Yeah.
I feel like following Peter Sagan in any classic is a recipe for disaster.
Well, he didn't commit.
Better than following Philippe Gilbert on the descent of the Poggio.
Crashing.
That was wild. And it would have been a completely different thing. I see there's some notes here. Let's talk about how that crash affected the race. I think it's significant, especially with, Eddie Quickstep was out of the equation because we knew that Kwiatkowski was in there. Cavendish was on a crook day. We were pretty aware of that as well. So it would have been interesting to see how different it was.
And Scholik, I mean, you know, post race, he was saying I had a lot in my legs.
Yeah, I mean, the guys that were in that crash, Scholik, Stuyber, was Gilbert. I mean, Fabian Cancellara didn't go down, or he didn't lose his race, but I mean, all of that sort of stuff costs the way that move is going to go forward, and then it changes the whole dynamic because all the attackers are then out of the running, which means the sprinters is going, okay, well, fantastic.
Yeah. It was red against blue on the climbs, wasn't it? We saw a lot of Sky and a lot of BMC, and Van Avermaet was great, and obviously Philippe Gilbert was feeling good, but he took that. Was it Gilbert's bike that bounced off the side where he crashed and caused the crash of Kwiatkowski and everyone? Is that how you saw it?
Yeah, because Cancellara described it as like Gilbert just going everywhere, and he was lucky that he didn't get caught up in it, because I think it was that descent is already quite difficult at the best of times, and
it's very hairy, and I'm not sure I don't think it would be disrespectful to Degenkolb to say that that crash would have changed. If that crash hadn't happened, it would have changed the outcome of the race, because if, on the descent of the Poggio, it's all about positioning. And to be frank, those guys were not in the best position at the time the crash happened.
Can I just talk about one guy, because that was a surprise to me, is Nasser Bouhanni.
Yep.
Right, he had an absolute fantastic race to finish sixth. He's not exactly the kind of guy you'd expect to see at the end of a 300-kilometer race with that punchy finish. You would say, characteristically, that's not the kind of race that he would do well in, but there he was at the end. Okay, he didn't have much support, but still, sixth.
Yeah, we're used to seeing him, I think, in Milan San Remo, sort of take the early ejection seat and just wave goodbye, because you wouldn't call him soft. You wouldn't nowhere near call him soft, but he does seem to sort of give up sometimes when you think maybe you should just keep going and see how you go. He's obviously a wunderkind type of talent, but one thing that was interesting going to me about his race was that he pretty much rode
himself.
Yeah, it wasn't Cofidis, it was Bouhanni, which may not bode so well for the rest of the season for him, because sprinting these days is so much about the team.
Yeah, and he's clearly a talent, and I thought that was one of the rides of the day. As invisible as he was.
For me, the sprint was weird because I was so convinced about Michael, so I pretty much just I found my eyes locked on the Orica Green Edge jersey, and I was following him, and I was. I have to say it was pretty exciting. I was on the tee until the Poggio, and then suddenly when he was sitting fourth wheel all the way up there, I rushed into the kitchen, grabbed a beer, and thought, right, I'll watch the end with a beer. That's at 3 o'clock in the morning. So there you go. Sorry about that. But I was so excited.
The replay, if you watch the replay race 4 or 5 times, I'm going, wait, Degenkolb won. Okay, wait, I need to watch that again. It was just, you're watching Christoph, and you're going, Christoph's going to win, and then you... Degenkolb wins, and then Degenkolb. What?
I had an interesting chat with Robbie McEwen about it yesterday, just to get his perspective, because it's always interesting. He got a fourth once upon a time, and he thinks it was the Via Roma, and he told amazing stories about Milan San Remo. But his big criticism was the fact that Christoph probably should have won it. Because he was obviously the strongest, except that he was in the wind for too long. And he said his last lead-out man, just instead of just going until he was empty, he went and then pulled over really suddenly. And Robbie has always asked his lead-out man, when you see me come past, that's when you know your turn is over. And in other words, keep going. Even if you're slowing down, don't pull over and make it obvious, because then everyone else plays their card. And that was an interesting take. I'll have to...
watch the replay again and
go over it again. But there's two schools of thought for the lead out. Is okay, I'm done, I'm out of here. But that's probably third or fourth last man, not the last man. And the last man should just go until the sprinter comes past. So
I would say that Milan San Remo also shows that even the top guys, the most experienced guys, can crack under pressure, because there was a number of poor moves being made by experienced guys that you wouldn't otherwise see. It's just the pressure cooker situation of those final kilometres. It's already so tense going off the Poggio, and then they've got 3 kilometres to regroup before a sprint, and you don't have big lead outs because that group was only 30 strong. So it's so disorganised, and really Degenkolb, he thrives in chaos.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't really talked about Degenkolb that much, but, and I suppose it's because of, the fact he didn't really do much in the race, but big win for his career, Milan San Remo, that's huge on his palmarès. But where does he now go from here? Because he's not a bad rider for the Cobble Classics. He can go to Flanders, he can go to Roubaix, he can go to Gent-Wevelgem, he can go to this week at Harelbeke, the race that shall not be named, and do something there. He's obviously in very good form, and he seems to be the kind of guy that is going to start winning these races, because he's very level-headed and he's got a very big engine.
Yeah, I mean, where have we seen in recent history where we've got two great sprinters on the same team, and they've managed those personalities so well, but they're both very different, and I think that's what's led to part of their success.
Yeah, they've got options. And Degen Kolb comes out when it's a little bit harder, and Kittel's there for when it's just a super drag race. So, you know, you can see the differences in sprinting technique. We referenced Degen Kolb last year in some race that he was in, and we were talking about his lovely bobbing head style. And Robbie had said to me, if he could control that, he'll go a lot faster. I think he might have controlled it because it wasn't as animated as usually is. Did anyone else sort of notice?
Yeah, I mean, when you compare it with some of his stage wins, you know, when he won four wins at the Vuelta, I mean, his head was hitting handlebars pretty much.
You used to pick him from the crowd pretty easily, but he seemed very smooth and efficient, and he was on the right wheel. He just did that. For the final finishing touch, he just came off the wheel perfectly.
Now, one thing that I think...
He had a lovely lead out from Christoph. It was very nice of him.
Yeah, I mean, maybe some money will change hands, or maybe it won't.
Actually, that's the beauty of Christoph. He doesn't have the acceleration, so he provides
it's a very smooth little
lead out.
One thing that you guys, I suppose, touched on there is that Kittel has flagged that he wants to go to the cobbled races this year and give them a go. What does that mean in that sense? Because Kittel might go to a few of these races and think potentially that he could win them.
Well, yeah, that's Kent Vavelken more than
sure. Yeah.
But Kittel did say he wants to perform at races like Roubaix, but he's going to ride those races this year as sort of like a stagiaire in a way. You know, he's going to be there just to get the hang of riding the cobbles, etc. But I'm pretty sure I
don't imagine he'll be getting the water bottles.
No, you get my point, right? It's just like he's going to be there to give it a bit of a crack, just to get accustomed to riding cobbles. But I'm pretty sure I remember the rumor mill saying even a month ago that the Degen Kolb was looking to leave Jeyne Alpecin.
Really?
All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right, because this will be a problem at some point. I mean, I think there's enough of a crossover for Jeyne Alpecin. It may be a problem to manage at some point in the future.
Well, you got to cash in on your dollars as well.
Well,
I think
the thing, you know. So
I think they've got a formidable lineup, and they do have, you know, different tactics. And Adam Hansen was referencing them when we were talking about lead out trains and their mechanisms. And Adam was saying about Lotto Soudal, it's always the same sequence, no matter what. It's always X, Y, Z, Greipel. And but Alpecin or Jeyne Alpecin, they switch it around dramatically depending on what the terrain is and which sprinter they've nominated for the day. So they do really run off. Okay, today, John, it's your turn. Okay,
in
Marcel.
In fact, ahead of last year's Tour de France, they actually did a video about their team announcement. And under each rider's name, they had their role, but they had their role on a flat sprint and their role on what they called a power sprint. Mm. And it was radically different.
Exactly.
You know, you'd have someone like Dumoulin doing, you know, something like, oh, he's just going to be domestique today, rather than maybe the last guy for Degen Kolb potentially.
Mm.
So really quite interesting, you would see a lineup that dynamic. But I suppose that they have to do that because they have two sprinters who are very talented.
Yep.
Guys, let's talk about Oleg Tinkov and Bjarne Riis, and we'll get there after this short break. Well, it all started when Oleg Tinkov and Bjarne Riis had a row at Tirreno Adriatico over the team's alleged poor performance and added fuel to the fire when he scolded the Dane publicly in Le Keep. And he didn't really do himself or that the relationship any favours with what he said. But interestingly, Tinkov Saxo sort of kept a lid on things for a few days, and they... Even when they released this public statement a few days ago about what's going on, is Riis suspended, is he not? They said he was not suspended of his active role because of lack of results, nor for financial issues, but he is currently inactive, whatever that means. Tanny, the Oleg Tinkov Bjarne Riis thing has been going on for a long time, but it seems unusual. Maybe in the context, I mean, okay, yes, they've won, two races this year, but they haven't really had a terrible start to the season. You wouldn't fault them on their season start, would you?
I think they could have been, I mean, every team could have been better, but I will say, he's certainly, Oleg Tinkov is not like Donald Trump. I mean, I like Donald when he goes, when you're fired, you're fired. And this one's like, well, you are fired, but you're not. But... I don't think you'll see Riis back in the team ever. That's, I mean, there's no chance, there's no plan of recourse for him to return to Tinkoff Saxo. I mean, it's gone now, and I think we have to...
Really? You're making that call?
Yeah, yeah. I don't see Reece joining... returning to the
but
team.
I mean, like, I mean, I think one of the interesting things that's come out of this is the fact that, you know, the sponsors that Reece has brought on board, for example, Saxo Bank came out, I think
today.
Last night or today, you know, saying this was Lars Sayer Christensen, who's the co-founder of Saxo, and he says, I obviously respect the owner of the team, and he's entitled to make arrangements as to what he wants. But I would like to emphasise that Bjarne Reece's proven leadership is a significant driver behind Saxo Bank's sponsorship of the team in the last 8 seasons. I mean, that's a veiled threat if ever there was one. And interestingly, Tinkoff's own comments that he spoke to L'Équipe were more about Bjarne Reece not getting actively involved as much as he would like rather than anything else. It's an odd criticism, really.
Look, Oleg... you know, look, Twitter's an interesting thing when you follow people on Twitter. Look, Oleg's obviously a pretty smart businessman. He's very forthright, et cetera, et cetera. But you follow someone on Twitter long enough and, you know, basically we see his, you know, regular daily, hourly, minute by the minute brain farts. And you get an idea into the kind of person he is. And Russians are interesting people because, you know... They can be both incredibly dark and sarcastic, but also they can be very emotional people as well. And Oleg is definitely in the emotional category, you know. So me, I kind of disagree with Anthony on this. I think, you know, Oleg's the kind of guy that where, you know, a hug and a kiss is what brings it all back together. He's that kind of person. He's this large in life, incredibly magnanimous, probably generous in some areas, but can be a real son of a bitch at other times if he has to be. And
yeah, I think a few, you know, magnums between Reece and Tinkoff will, you know, sort that out, and then they'll get into the vodka or whatever
and then they see, you know, they're having him pashing in the corner somewhere. Yeah.
They'll hug again.
Yeah, they'll hug it out. They'll hug it out.
So you just think Reece is benched?
I think Tinkoff is kind of fun to follow because you can clearly see that he's passionate about it, but... if you invest a lot of money into a team and they're coming second a lot, then allow him to express his frustration. That happened a lot. It happened a lot more dramatically at BMC a couple of years ago when John Lalonde had an off season and poof, he was gone. But you know, we could talk about cycling management for a while, and you said, we've touched on it before here and there. Mm. But I think the Tinkoff one is interesting because he does tend to. It seems to be late night inducements. Let's say that, and rash decisions seem to be made, and then I think he might sort of wake up and just sort of think,
wait,
oh, hang on a tick, that was a bit okay. Come on, Bjarne, come back over, give us a hug, mate, and let's get back into it.
But poor performance alone. I mean, how poor are they really going? I mean, this is a team that won the Vuelta last year with Alberto Contador, and really, I mean, the big goals are the Giro and the Tour, and last year's Tour obviously was a train wreck because he crashed. I mean, you're sort of being a bit selective, I think, if you look at their team and go, well, they're not really doing as well as they could.
They're not doing as badly as Garmin, Cannondale Garmin. I
mean, what team is that, Matt?
You remember them? They were in the World Tour.
They're in the World
2015,
Tour.
2015, yeah.
No, I mean...
They haven't won a single race this year. Okay, now they're supposed to be a big-ticket team.
Mm-hmm. Right? We're not in April yet.
That's true, but, you know...
Dan they get to June and
Dan
it's still
Martin
like
out of Liège, Bastogne-Liège, I feel, is unlikely, but we'll see.
Yeah.
He's going well at Catalunya, though, so...
I missed Catalunya last night. Anyway.
No, right, we're talking about results this season. Tinkoff Saxo have underperformed. Last season, no, they performed very well considering the circumstances
of
the tour.
Yeah, but beyond March. Beyond March, like they started picking up wins in the Giro and
that's what I'm saying.
Tour de France and different places, but that hasn't happened this season yet.
Yeah, it's not beyond March.
That's what I'm saying. So far, I don't think they're performing. And then I'm not sure, is it appropriate for a team owner? Okay, it's great for the media, the Twitterati, to follow Tinkoff's brain farts, as Phil says, but, you know, is it appropriate for a team owner to be doing this? I sort of question that, and given that, you know, these teams are you know, a lot of the reason why, I guess, sponsors gravitate towards teens is because of the image. Now, the image that he's projecting isn't particularly consistent with one which values, you know, of one of harmonious values. Mm.
But you get the feeling with Reese as well that he comes and goes with his interest. At the moment, he's probably like, oh, well, you know, it's early
season.
None
doesn't really matter. It's all...
I've got my money. I've won the tour. I've sort of handed over the tour, you know.
But...
And I've had this awesome team and we've done lots of things along the way and I'm just going to go and drink some wine in Tuscany.
Mm.
And then he's like, hang on a sec, the tour is coming up. But yep. I want to be there. And I think that we'll probably see a bid from Reese to come back and say, come on, I've got some good tactics.
He'll be there. He'll be there for the Giro. Like, you could see that he could end up being there for the Giro, being there for the tour.
Motivation ebbs and flows for everyone.
That's the thing. I mean, you know, you're probably looking at the money he's getting paid by Tinkoff, and Tinkoff saying, well, I need you to be more regular. But then Reese is probably thinking, yeah, but we got all these other DSs, and really they need to be in the car and they need to pull their weight as well. Mm. And he's kind of like the DS of all the DSs.
Well,
it's like,
I mean, it's. I mean,
he wants to be in the big races.
If you want to draw a parallel to BMC,
that's where he gets his juice from.
But Phil, if you want to draw a parallel to BMC as well, I mean, I think, you know, Alan Piper spoke very at length about this last year when he joined BMC. Well, not when he joined BMC, but when he sort of really took a step back as the team's sporting manager. And that role, I think, is very much the same as what Bjarne Riis does. Head DS is kind of, it's a vague term these days. But spending time not in the car is far more useful for that level of manager, because they're then looking at the whole season. They're looking at every rider. They're taking a much more holistic approach. And that's what Lelong got criticised a lot for. He spent too much time in the car and he wasn't doing enough of the big picture. So I don't know, maybe is sort of Tinkoff want to have his cake and eat it too sort of situation?
I just don't think that you can easily throw a guy like Bjarne Riis out of your team because of what he brings to the team when it matters.
Well, he brings a sponsor.
he brings a lot of money. But at the same time, you know, Bjarne, I think we'd all agree here, right? He's one of the more crafty tacticians on the road. Mm.
Well, it depends who you ask. I mean, I know that, you know, some people, yeah, always say, oh, Riis was the, you know, he was the one who basically set things up for the Schleckys and the Sastre at the Tour de France and stuff like that. You ask other people, they say it was another DS.
Oh, Kim Anderson.
Yeah. So I'm not sure. And then also, yeah, I sort of agree with Rob ever since that. Well, Rob didn't sort of say this outright, but I mean, when Riis sold his entire share to Tinkoff, he seems to have been less enthusiastic. He's less involved.
Mm. In any case, leaving the team in all sorts of, I suppose, uncertainty about, you know, certainly from the rider's perspective, because I don't think this is the sort of environment that you want to be fostering when they are approaching major objectives. Who's leading the team? Are we in crisis? Are we going to even exist next year? I mean, all those questions are going to weigh on you.
Exactly. I mean, Contador was approached on stage two of Catalunya. He said, I just know what you guys know. So they hadn't been informed.
Yeah, but he also said, I basically support Riis as well, which was interesting. I think there's a lot, I mean, Riis has a lot of respect. You can't cross him without repercussions. I mean, he is a lot of the reason that a lot of these riders are involved with the team. I mean, I know Tinkoff's dollars are important, but Tinkoff had his own team a few years ago and he had a lot of dollars. And I tell you what, the talent that he attracted wasn't quite the same. So Bjarne is a big asset. Yeah. You can't just throw him aside.
Yeah, but I think he's also introduced new thinking to the sport, where even the boot camps, which weren't too prevalent with many teams, 10 years ago.
We're talking about Bjarne here still.
And Bjarne introduced those. And I know even guys like Brad McGee, who's got his development team at NSWIS, New South Wales Institute of Sport, you know, he had a boot camp just last weekend down in the Highlands, and he was still referencing what he'd learned from Riis and how he's passing that on to the kids, you know, just about resilience and not about any physicality. It's a mental approach. He really wanted to push his young riders to be on the exhaustion point and see what rational decision that they made. And that's this kind of thinking that Bjarne Riis introduced to it. And he's been there. He's done something interesting. And I don't know, once you've done something interesting for a few years at the highest level, surely your interest does begin to wane a little, and maybe that's part of that equation, and it's not why and why the results are a little bit more erratic than they than Tinkoff might like them to be. I don't know.
I want to give a shout out to probably one of the best pieces written on this, which was by Daniel Freebie at Cycling News. He's written a piece called Tinkoff and Rees: The Anatomy of Power Struggle, which is pretty insightful, I thought, from both sides. You know, just a really nice, balanced, well-written insight into some of the issues that may be playing itself out with the team. It's worth a read. Go to Cycling News, have a look for it.
Totally. All right. Well, maybe we'll leave it that there and talk about the Volta Catalunya, because we could probably talk about this all day, and Phil is very insistent on this being a shorter podcast.
Thank you.
Well, after three stages in the Catalan, the Volta Catalunya remains nicely poised, only Townie's least favourite American, TJ Van Garderen, and losing ground after an untimely crash. He's shaking his head as I say this. With Nairo Quintana sitting the race out, it's over to Chris Froome, Alberto Contador, Rigoberto Urán, Domenico Portavivo et al. And that's not me, that's just Latin for Ali, which is others, to duke it out. Guys, Catalunya, it's the sort of the next stage race after Paris-Nice and Torino-Adriatico. It's sort of the gateway to...
The Giro.
Well, Romandy as well, I suppose.
So but you have two 1 week races with two time trials apiece, and then you have another 1 week race with no time trials. Does that make a difference?
Yeah, I mean...
Just a thought.
Well...
And last year it had terrible weather. This year, how are we looking? Are we tracking all right in Catalunya?
I think tracking better this year. There's been no major warnings of any major weather.
Yeah, well...
It was pretty ordinary when Valverde won.
Yeah, they had it was at stage two that the whole broadcast was put on a spike because they couldn't... They literally had nothing to show.
Mm.
Right? So that was it. No TV pictures.
Yeah.
Good.
That saves a bit.
It was like when I was watching the Cricket World Cup the other day and there was a rain delay and they just talked in the studio for about 6 hours.
Kind of like we're doing here.
Yeah. It was quite interesting, actually, because they were talking about...
Do you reckon they could do that?
I think we probably could.
Yeah. They were talking about the last World Cups where South Africa had choked. Anyway, that's neither here nor there.
What's this cricket you speak of?
Yeah, well, exactly. It's another sea sport or something. But
so
guys,
Pierre Rolland's in the lead. Is that what's happened overnight?
Pierre Rolland is in the lead. He basically got ahead a couple of days ago through a breakaway, and he now has a big advantage over a lot of the main contenders, I suppose you could call them. For those that are listening, I just did the, you know, rabbit ears, but I can't actually.
Yeah, we got it.
That. Yeah, good.
We're here, so it's not confusing, but he's talking about making a quote mark.
Yeah, that's it. Contador, Pozzovivo, Richie Port were in a strong move the other yesterday on stage three, and they're looking very good.
Who was with Richie? Who was last man with Sky?
Well, Froome was in the group behind, but they were in a bit of a break. So
Froome's what? He's just sort
20
of...
20 seconds.
Like 19 seconds,
is he? Yeah. Is he just warming up?
Well, it's hard to say. I think they're just playing a bit of a... They're not doing the... You know, this is what we've seen in the last few races for Sky. We've seen them move away from this last man sort of one, like, you know, sort of this final, I don't know, hard pace, one man left and then go. I think they're doing a lot more cat and mouse. They're doing a lot more, well, we've got two cars to play. Let's play them properly rather than going and doing silly things like they've done the last few years.
Here's what 5 through 10 looks like. Rigoberto Urán, Dan Martin, Alberto Contador, Richie Port, Fabio Aru, and Andrew Talansky.
Yeah.
That's 5 through 10.
That's a pretty good lineup, isn't it?
Yeah, one through four is Roland, Paterski, De Klerk, and Pozzovivo.
Mm-hmm.
Right now,
the top three are all from that break, and they've slowly been losing time.
That's right.
But they might not lose enough because it's a big gap.
It'll be tight, but...
Has Roland got a TUE?
Shh.
Sorry.
Does Froome?
Is this going to become a corticosteroid, you know, whole podcast again?
We'll know tonight the result because they have a mountaintop finish. And then the next three stages, well, pretty much not much will happen. So I think the race will be decided tonight on La Molina.
And Contador said he's going to give it a shake, so...
Yeah. Good shake of the sauce bottle. Yeah. Let's not talk about speculating about the actual race, but, Tanya, you mentioned this is a point of significance. Last race for Contador before the Giro, that's obviously his first major objective, and then after this I imagine he'll be heading to some team camps to prepare for the first Grand Tour, the Italian Grand Tour, the Giro d'Italia. But you know, what do you think he wants to get out of this race? I mean, win it or just get some more racing days in the legs? Or
no, I don't think he won't be overly disappointed if he doesn't win. And yeah, I think you were a bit surprised out that he's taking this amount of time off. But remember how Quintana prepared for his debut Tour de France. He took a month off there. How he prepared before the Giro, he took a month off there. Took a month off before he took the lead of the Vuelta, then subsequently crashed out. So, and then plus he's going for two Grand Tours this season, so he doesn't really want to do too many race days, I'd imagine.
Isn't he going for three?
Three? No, just the Giro Tour. Mm. Just the Giro Tour.
Yeah, which is the sort of the impossible trinity in itself.
I just thought Tinkoff might have upped the ante. I don't know.
Well, I mean, maybe...
It was an attempt at humour. See, I got the retrospective laugh thing.
Well, it was more because of the... Yeah.
Thank you. Anyway.
Guys, one guy that we haven't really mentioned is Jürgen Vandenbroek. Now, the only reason I mention this is because at the start of the year...
Yeah, we didn't talk about him. Isn't that amazing? But he's been so prominent.
No, but at the start of the year, he flagged that he was not going to be going to the Tour de France and he would be focusing on shorter stage races. Mm. Now, we've had a few shorter stage races so far, and Jürgen Vandenbroek, for me, hasn't... I mean, we're not talking about him, as you said, Rob.
Mm.
Problematic for a guy that's said his main objectives are these races. What's going on? Is this guy going to...
Well, Garmin Canada should sign him up as a Grand Tour rider, shouldn't they? And he'll produce the necessary results which are consistent with
What did Garmin Cannondale do to hurt you? You hate them.
No, he doesn't. He also hates BMC, okay. So yeah, that's right.
And I don't hate TJ. Yeah. I think he's... I just don't think he's going to win...
I said least favourite. I didn't say you hated him.
Back to Vandenbroek.
I just don't think he's going to win a Grand Tour.
But back to Jürgen.
Jürgen.
You know, I mean, he showed so much promise so many years ago. And it just hasn't been fulfilled. Accidents.
So much pressure from the Belgian press. You should see them all over him at the Tour. Mm. I felt sorry for the bloke. I mean,
what was it, 2012 Tour? He finished just off the podium.
Yeah. Fourth.
I mean, he's not a bad rider, obviously, but it's something hasn't clicked the last few years.
Yeah, well, it's entirely possible, too, that once they announce his schedule for this year, that, you know, with no Tour, you never know. I mean, he's taking a bit of a knock and... His confidence is shot to pieces and he's just...
So maybe we should be looking at the Eneco Tour and saying that is where Jürgen's going to shine.
Big time.
Can't wait for the Eneco Tour.
That's always a big season highlight for me. Right after the Tour, you know, you're not fatigued at all and you really care about cycling at that point. Mm. And then you go to Eneco and you're like, yes!
Yeah, you're not thinking at all about how many more months it is to the end of the year and when you can take your holidays.
Look at that beautiful industrial estate.
Yeah, and that complements nicely with the Tour of Poland. You know, two races that I would just love to go to and really write about in detail because they really just... Anyway,
the Dutch accents are so alluring, aren't they?
Right, you know, Al Hines down and out at the tail end of the cycling world tour season
in the Benelux.
That's right.
Oh god!
I don't think we covered Jürgen Vandenbroek at all.
No, we haven't. I mean, that's the thing. Apart from mentioning what his schedule is going to be this year, what the change of direction was, it seemed to me that Lotto was going to use him as a guy to accumulate World Tour points.
Mm.
So he was going to be the guy they were going to look for in these smaller races where, you know, he's going to finish first, second, third, whatever. He's going to pick up a stage win. He's going to do something. He'll get them World Tour points. That hasn't happened.
Maybe they realized
we haven't talked about him at all this year.
Maybe they realized in the absence of any real competition for World Tour points, because there's no real other teams vying for World Tour spots.
Certainly not.
They didn't
Canada.
Need Jürgen to do anything, so Jürgen just went on an extended holiday and just comes back to race occasionally.
It's just weird. The guy's just dropped off the map.
It is weird. I mean, it's for a guy, as we said, for a guy that finished fourth at the 2012 Tour de France. He has completely dropped off the map.
Yeah, it's not that weird. I mean, it's more weird that we're spending a lot of time talking about him in an Australian cycling podcast. But no,
let's talk about the Izaguirre brothers. They're much more interesting.
We talked about them last week. We talked about them last week.
You know what? Can we save that one for a little while? We're going to bank that, right? So what we're going to do is we're going to chart the Izaguirre brothers.
Okay.
Sounds good. And we're going to have a look at their performances.
This will be, I mean, podcast listeners right now will be going, gee, that's fuck, that's whet the appetite, hasn't it?
That's right.
John and Gorka.
And then we'll come back.
Between and that and the Benelux tour.
If you go up a climb in the Pyrenees during the Tour de France, I tell you, there's one name that's written more than any other, and that's Izaguirre. Yeah. And I asked John and Gorka about that, and they said, yes, a friend of ours is a painter.
So it's really just one guy. It just looks like there's a whole bunch of people.
I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah, that's Cycling just, I mean, Central.
The name is as relevant as Jürgen Vanderpoel, only there's two of them.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's twice as relevant.
Yeah.
Our listeners are apoplectic with excitement at the moment.
Okay, no, but actually this brings up an interesting point, because it's like, you know, you head in, every season is like a fresh new slate, and you know, teams announce what riders are going to do, etc. And, you know, then riders like Jürgen Vanderbroek tend to fall through the cracks, especially if you're in the English-speaking world. They're not riders you tend to follow. But if you follow cycling, right, then you do actually start wondering about guys like that.
Well, maybe we can make an ongoing segment called Riders That We Haven't Talked About
that's
Much.
That's right, yeah, riders we haven't talked about, or what has happened to such and such.
I want to hear the person who did the call for the Tour of Taiwan in stage four.
Oh, no.
Can we go on this name? I'm going to just try and read it verbatim. It's his first name is Mirzamad.
Oh, yeah, this guy.
And then here we go. Pour Seyedigolakour. Maybe. But anyway, he's leading GC of Tour of Taiwan.
He's rather present, you could say, in the Asian race scene.
Yeah, he's an ongoing concern.
Now, right now, leading the Tour of Taiwan are three Iranians.
Yes.
One who is 39, the other one who's 40.
Yeah.
Two of them have served time for an adverse analytical finding for all sorts of
Now, Phil,
stuff,
what are you trying to stuff. Say?
And
come out with it, sir.
It's just the same. It's so funny reading. How do we get on this topic anyway?
No, because of the spelling of this. I mean, just the length of this guy's name. I don't know how many letters there are.
Neither here nor there. But yes, go on with your last point, and then we will finish this podcast.
The best thing about following the Tour of Taiwan, and with all due respect to the Avanti guys who are providing so much comedy for me, right, is reading the Avanti team website reports where they go, here we go again, right? This always happens. These guys on the climbs at all these Asian races will just take off and leave us here. And of course, you know, Avanti, they're not even hiding their contempt, you know, for what they think is going
Patrick
on.
Patrick Bevan's
these guys.
Putting on a show. He's doing.
He's
well.
Fantastic. Actually, if I were the Iranian guys, I'd be going, "We're on this stuff." So imagine what. You know, how good is this guy?
But if he was on that
stuff, yeah.
Okay, it's Taiwan, it's not Catalonia, but what is the limit for Patrick Bevan? He just seems to be able to do everything.
Yeah, I don't know.
Except for beat.
Maybe it's World Tour would be the limit.
I believe he's going World Tour next year.
This has really turned into a pub talk, hasn't it?
Yeah, let's get out of this.
Should we sign off? Thanks a lot.
Yeah. So thanks, guys. It's been a pleasure, as it sometimes is. Actually, it was quite funny this week, I thought.
Yeah, people are either still listening or they're not.
Or they're not, exactly. Yeah,
they've
so
just walked away.
That's pretty much as per normal.
Rip the headphones.
Thanks
out.
For joining us. Don't forget, for all your news, blogs, videos, pics and more, we're always online creating content at sbs.com.au/cyclingcentral, and it will soon look very new with a new design. Will it not, Phil?
Yes, it will.
That's pretty cool. Bye for now.